Roommates line up in a row, time to turn on the camera, start the show. They kiss babies with a tie, tried every soundbite that might fly. But be they congressmen or preachers, the only ones who made the features were those who knew their station. Is that a man or a corporation? Won that round, went on to the big buck battleground. They bought some ads, they bought some more. They got freebies by the score. Hired thugs went door to door, especially if you're black or poor. Said your vote might be against the law. Don't tell me the deal is raw. We had an election, it ain't no lie. It was the best one money could buy. Reported every word uttered by these two old birds as if their tongues were heaven sent. They didn't tell us what was meant, no voting record to analyze. And watch as they feign surprise when history proves to us again the thieving crooks who are these men. We had an election, it ain't no lie. It was the best one money could buy. Not a word from those dirty commie peacenik nerds. There will be debates, slogans will fly, but only rich men need apply. There's only room up there for two, Tweedledee and Tweedledoo. Uncounted ballots will litter the floor in this banana Republican class war. We had an election, it ain't no lie. It was the best one money could buy. Said and done, the pundits will say democracy won. Some will cry into their socks, some will sit and watch more Fox, where scandals, wars, and desperation are all the fault of the United Nations, while those who drill the oil, make the tanks, laugh out loud all the way to the banks. We had an election, it ain't no lie. It was the best one money could buy.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can listen to this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. Coming up first, Atnaht Atmadi. She takes a critical look at the banking industry and argues that the system can be made safer without adversely affecting the public. Then after that, Bill McKibben and Chris Mooney talk about the Keystone XL pipeline, the Do the Math Tour, and the rallying of students call for their universities to divest from fossil fuel companies.
The Banker's New Clothes is a new book by Stanford professor Atnaht Atmadi. What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It is the subtitle. Professor Atmadi, what's this cartoon on the front of the book?
Well, it shows a few naked bankers just wearing ties and this mother and child kind of staring at them, and it represents some of the content of the book, unfortunately.
Well, you open the book with the Emperor's New Clothes story. Why?
Well, because banking has a certain mystique to it, and so when people say something with a straight face and they are dressed nicely and they appear like they know what they're talking about, people think they might be missing something, or they might not understand, or it's just not good business to say something. It's just more convenient not to challenge what they say, but we try to actually do the opposite and expose flawed arguments. So the Banker's New Clothes refers to a whole collection of flawed arguments that are made that actually sometimes nonsense doesn't matter, but this nonsense does matter.
The Banker's New Clothes, a major reason for the success of bank lobbying is that banking has a certain mystique. There is a pervasive myth that banks and banking are special and different from all other companies and industries in the economy. Anyone who questions the mystique and the claims that are made are at risk of being declared incompetent to participate in the discussion.
Yep, it's true.
How strong is the banking lobby in the U.S.?
very strong. After the crisis in 2009, it was Senator Durbin who said, frankly, Wall Street owns the place. In Europe, the politics is a little different, but there's a big problem, political problem, and that's what I learned more and more as I became involved. It's not about making valid arguments. It's not necessary or sufficient to be successful in the policy debate.
Why?
Unfortunately. Well, because there are convenient narratives that people prefer to have, and there seem to be also some entrenched real misunderstandings, shockingly, held by all kinds of people who you would think should know better. And so it's hard to sort out sometimes why people say what they say. Are they really, some people say to me, they just don't understand these subtle things. But I think that's really weird. Why wouldn't they understand? These are bread and butter finance sometimes we're talking about. And it's part of the mystique. Somehow, when you go into banking, you suspend all judgment. It's all different. So here is the rest of the economy. You have a lot of companies and a lot of corporations. They do things. They fund what they do. Banks somehow are different. They are allowed to say things that you wouldn't think make any sense in the context of other corporations, and that are they just behave differently, but somehow it's inferred that that's okay.
Well, one of the arguments you make in your book is about equity.
Yes.
And capital.
Yes.
And first of all, you define those.
Yes.
For people. And what are the arguments you make about those?
Well, I mean, one of the most insidious things that's going on is that everybody uses this word capital, and with capital regulations, everybody talks about capital, capital, capital. And it really turns out that most people don't understand what this word means in the context of banking. And because of the way the words that are used around it and the way the discussion is framed, you're just sent off to an entirely different debate, which is not the debate that is actually relevant here. So you would read oftentimes that capital is that banks are required to hold capital or set aside capital. And the analogy is often made, or the implication is made, that this is like a rainy day fund. This is like a pile of cash that sits idle. But that's not what we're talking about. We're only talking about how the banks fund what they do. The fact that whether they do it with borrowed money or with money that most companies use, which is their retained profits and the owner's money or the shareholder's money, which is happily used by the rest of the economy. We don't force anybody to fund, you know, to avoid borrowing. But the banks, people don't discuss this frequently, fund almost everything they do with borrowed money. And oops, when you take risk with borrowed money, sometimes the investments don't work out and you can't pay your debt or you become distressed. And that is fundamentally what's wrong with banking, is a pervasiveness of essentially a fundamental conflict of interest between a borrower and a creditor. In this case, a borrower and taxpayers.
Well, Professor Admati, you write in here that bank debt is often 90% plus of a bank's assets. Is that too much?
That's too much, way too much. We don't see companies fund that way, and there's a reason for it. This is a very unhealthy funding mix. Somebody who borrows so much, a corporation that borrows so much, in fact, any borrower, private borrowers, government borrowers are a little bit different. You know, they have other ways maybe to try to fund their debt, their payment, but of course we're not going to go into that in this discussion. But any private borrower that gets so highly indebted starts being constrained in what they do or just distorted in the way they make decisions about what they do later, about the risk they take, about the kinds of investments that are attractive and not attractive. Distorted decisions, so because some of the downside of the decisions is borne by the creditor. And if the borrower, like a corporation, can walk away from those debts, or, oops, might be having deposit insurance pay, or the government pay, or the central bank gives them support, or whatever, then their creditors are nicer to them than they would have been to other borrowers. And that's how the banks get to borrow as much as they do, that other people kind of wouldn't be able to or wouldn't choose to, and their creditors kind of would tell them not to. And so the banks get into this position, and fundamentally what's pushing them is a basic tendency for borrowing to become addictive, and the fact that we feed on that addiction and allow and encourage it perversely to keep doing it, by so doing encouraging harmful things, as if we were to subsidize somebody polluting the river when they have a clean alternative. It's a really perverse system.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Socialists we got out there tonight. Come on, let's see a show of left hands. You drive here on a public street, socialist. You go to a public school, socialist. You ever visit a public library? Why? Tell you why, because you're a socialist, like Ulysses S. Grant, Yellowstone National Park. You ever been there? Yeah, you're a socialist, like Teddy Pinko Roosevelt. That guy was talking about universal health care. You're a taxating, appropriating, regulating, nanny stating socialist. Dog got run over by a truck, and the socialist animal control people came and picked up my dog. Then my neighbor's house caught on fire, and the socialist fire department came and put it out. I could have snatched up that dog and cooked it on my neighbor's house. Another good meal ruined by socialism. You ever mail a letter? Of course you have, because you're a socialist. Like Dwight D. Eisenhower. That guy built highways between the states. Yeah, you're a socialist. Like Richard Red Diaper Nixon. He put food stamps on people's plates. Yeah, you're a taxating, appropriating, regulating, nanny-stating socialist. Screw in the light bulb. Too many. Four to requisition the light bulb. Four more to process the requisition in triplicate. Eight to manufacture the light bulb. Three to subsidize the manufacturing. Three to procure the light bulb. Two to supervise the manufacturing and procurement process. Seven to warehouse the light bulb for an indeterminate length of time. Four to deliver the light bulb to the wrong address. Four more to re-deliver the light bulb. Six to receive the light bulb. And one to screw it up. 47. How many capitalists does it take to screw in a light bulb? One impoverished nation willing to exploit its malnourished population and rape its natural resources to manufacture, package, and deliver the light bulb to Walmart. And me. You know why that's funny? Because you're a socialist. Like Ronald W. Reagan. Earned income tax credit. Yeah, you're a socialist. Like George W.S.S.R. Bush. That guy wrote the book on government interference. Of course, he never read it. You're a taxating, appropriating, regulating, nanny-stating, Stalin-hugging, Castro-kissing, Marx-filating, spawn-of-Satan, socialist. Every last one of y'all.
And now back to Atnat Atmati talking about the Banker's New Clothes.
Anat Admati teaches finance and economics at the Graduate School of Business here at Stanford University. Professor Admati, what role, in your view, did the banks play in the 2008 crisis?
Well, a major view. And really, they or other financial institutions, so it's not just what you might call bank, but, you know, whatever, investment banks, bank holding companies, even an insurance company like AIG, et cetera, various financial institutions that were all connected to one another. And we explain in the book how that kind of set of dominoes stand right next to one another, very, very interconnected, got themselves to take risk in all various different ways to fool the regulators about what was actually going on there, and to meanwhile do very well for themselves and put the rest of us at great risk. The regulators were complicit, and the politicians, because they liked the good days when they lasted and allowed the risk to build up in a way that really was harmful, ended up being very harmful. The reason we wrote this book is because they keep doing this, because the crisis didn't result in appropriate lessons and regulations, and so we are still endangered. So we wrote this book with great urgency and great concern that we have this system that's just about as bad. Even if the times look good now, they looked good in 2006 too, or look better now. Certainly in Europe, we're not even out of that crisis, and even in the U.S. we're not out of that crisis. Legacy mortgage loans, foreclosures, still a mess. So we're not done with that. But of course, one of the things we explain in the book too is that when you borrow so much, even if you do a little bit okay, it looks great, because leverage borrowing tends to magnify the upside and the downside. So doing a little bit well means doing seemingly really well. But that's because the risk worked out this time. That's the nature of risk. When we discover it didn't work out, it's often too late.
Your co-author is Martin Hellwig. Who is Martin Hellwig?
Martin Hellwig is actually somebody that I met first when I was a graduate student, and in a completely different topic. He was just a little bit ahead of me, and my dissertation research had to do with some research that he's done, early 80s. And our paths parted sometime in the late 80s, and he went on to, he's from Germany originally, and he was in Bonn, and then in Basel, actually, and then in Mannheim, and then back in Bonn in a research institute called the Max Planck Institute for Research on the Public Goods, or something like that. It's quite appropriate for what we're trying to do here. And what happened was, after the crisis, I started wondering what was going on in the financial system, and why it was created all these problems, and was there something to do about it, or was it like an earthquake that we kind of had to live through, a perfect storm? And there, I started reading the narratives and also the policy proposals, and the more I looked, the more kind of disturbed I was. And it started just with talking with academics, and there's a whole part there that I don't know that we'll get into, but I didn't like what I heard, and I didn't like what I didn't hear, the fact that I wasn't hearing certain things that seemed obvious to me, and I just started asking questions. Now, when I read, I came across a lecture that Martin Hellwig, about the crisis, and that made sense to me. So as I entered this and started writing, I established contact with Martin in early 2010. And we started exchanging views and ideas. I wrote something, and what he said made sense to me, whereas what a lot of other people said did not. And he was more involved in banking for 20, 25 years, so it was like, you know, I'm a newcomer. I come from just the field of, you know, corporate finance and corporate governance, looking into banking, saying, that's a really strange industry, very strange. It's a little bit of a rabbit hole feeling. And so, whoa. And, you know, to the point that I'd open a textbook and said, whoa, this would fail my students in my class, what they say. This is the epigraph of a chapter here called Paid to Gamble. It was shocking, shocking. Anyway, and so spring of 2010, towards the summer, I decided that basically I've heard enough nonsense that I was not going to just, you know, say something in the office and kind of complain to my friends and just go out there. Fortunately, I have tenure and I can't be scared into it and into, you know, keeping silent. Anyway, I was going to go into it. And then I called Martin, and I was alerted, actually, that there was some flawed things going on in Basel, which is where negotiations were taking place for an international agreement on these capital regulations. And I was alerted by people involved, once I started speaking up a little bit and asking questions, that somebody needed to kind of write out what the issues are around the debate and why what people were saying was wrong. And so I decided to include Martin because he knew more what people were saying in banking. So four of us wrote a kind of little manifesto in the summer and put it out there. And that was sort of the start. The book was the result of, after that, trying for a year with 24/7 to enter the debate and impact it in the face of, even for somebody from Stanford, some difficulty feeling any impact when people didn't want you to have an impact. So the book is basically going to a broader audience to say, here's what the story is, you judge whether they're doing right or whether something more needs to be done. Here is our story, how we want to teach it.
Professor Admati, who is this book written for? Is this an academic textbook?
It has part of it that is an academic textbook. It's written actually at multiple levels at the same time. This is a pretty much serious book about banking, and yet you don't have to read it that way. So you can read it as the layperson. You don't need to know anything. The entry point we decided after a lot of struggle with how to enter is a mortgage. Everybody's familiar with that, and we need a certain few sort of language terms. People need to understand what it means to take debt, what you do with debt, what happens when you don't pay your debt, the notion of insolvency, liquidity problems, what all these words mean. So we unpack a lot of the lingo around it, but we avoid jargon as much as possible. So everything is in terms that you know, pretty much, or whatever is new, we explain. And then we defer to the footnotes and to endnotes, which are extensive. Everything that is not essential for just reading through and really getting an understanding of the underlying forces that are at play here. Why are people wanting to do this? What are the motivations of the different people involved? So we kind of go to the heart of it, and it's not a crisis book. What I wanted to really avoid is to start with the story of that crisis. Because I've had to read a lot of crisis books, I'm so sick of it. I can't even stand it. So it's not really about this crisis. It's really about financial crisis, but it's also not about crisis. It's about a system that's just distorted every day because it's really not a healthy system. Every day. It can be muddling along. It can be even looking okay. And still it's not a functional system. It still is distorting the economy. It still doesn't have its right place in the economy.
Game and harmony calls my name. Things don't happen. But now for something completely different.